The following program is a presentation of the Flypod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com. This show consists of a conversation between Dr. John M. Cutter and Father Patrick Bossio. They discuss the similarities between Freemasons and the Knights of Columbus, two organizations with long histories of contributing to community building in the United States. Let's listen in.
Well, Father Pat, we've got two organizations that we belong to that are probably considered the preeminent men's organizations in the country. One of them is Knights Columbus, the other is the Freemasons. And what are the things that you think are the distinguishing characteristics of the Knights of Columbus?
Well, I'm chaplain to the local Knights of Columbus. I'll tell you how I found that out. They sent out a bulletin to all the members of the Knights of Columbus with upcoming events, and I saw on the third line, chaplain Father Pat Bossio, and that's how I found out I was their chaplain. I mean, I was happy to accept.
Sooner or later, you answer for every kind deed in this life. That's exactly it.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting because I really had no experience or real background with Knights of Columbus, either one. And I think it's safe to say for those who are joining us that as you're an officer of your organization, I've been a past officer of my Freemasonic Lodge, which is the component organization. And I was what was known as the Worshipful Master, which is the top of their cadre or their officer corps. And then I went on to a larger component of the organization, which is called Scottish Rite, which some people call higher grade masonry. And then eventually became an officer there and then went on to be a 33rd degree member, which is our highest honorary level. But in doing that, it was an interesting founding story that I came across. It seems that Knights of Columbus certainly grew out of a fraternal thrust in the United States that occurred from between about the late 1800s to the early 1900s, where we saw large organizations of one type or another, in our case it was male-oriented, that then led to community building. And it seems that where Masonry had a certain format that had come back from the early 1700s, Knights of Columbus grew out of that rubric, although it has distinct characteristics. And it was a Reverend Michael J. McGivney in 1882 out of New Haven, Connecticut. And maybe you could tell us a little bit more about what his overall approach was and why he felt compelled to start this particularly Catholic organization at that point. So,
well, I could tell you a little bit about that. But, you know, John, what I'd like to emphasize as we discuss this, I think when people have discussions, they come to it with a mindset. For example, last night I was with a wonderful group of Birch Society people. And, you know, when I told a few of my friends that I was invited to attend this Birch Society meeting, they said, "You're going to go with those loonies?" and so on. So, in other words, they have a mindset ahead of time. And I went there and I had a wonderful time. And I found a great deal of common ground with them on their thinking. So I'd like, when you and I are talking, I discovered when you and I had a telephone conversation that we don't have any pre-model that we're working on.
Oh, no, and yeah, and we shouldn't, I agree.
That's important for our listeners.
I think so, yeah. We don't, in terms of having biases, we have cultural backgrounds, and we've all gotten to perhaps the same place by different roads. But the issue is, no, I don't have an agenda here, one way or the other. Yeah. I think I'm exploring for the sake of exploration. So,
well, both of us are doing that. Mm-hmm. But as regards the origins of the Knights of Columbus, there is a story about. Although, when I asked several members of the Knights of Columbus about this, They said they had never heard of it. But I think there's enough historical evidence to say that one of the purposes of beginning the Knights of Columbus was to counteract the influence of the Masons. And I don't mean counteract in the sense of being against, but as an alternative for Catholic men.
Mm-hmm.
Which leads me to believe that the Catholics and Father McGivney himself must have thought that the Masons were really a very good idea, and they wanted something like that within the Catholic Church.
And it's certainly heavily borrowed from, at least from the degree standpoint, although, as I understand it, Knights of Columbus only have 4 degrees, where your 4th degree is your honorary degree. Freemasonry, within its component lodge system, has only 3 degrees, but then you can go on to either the York Rite or the Scottish Rite, and you can go all the way up to and including the honorary 33rd degree. And for listeners who aren't aware of what degrees are, at least in terms of Masonry's organization, a degree is basically an allegorical lesson of either morality or ethics that teaches a core principle of the organization. And then you advance through those core principles until you reach the highest level that you comfortably are willing to obtain. Overseas, it may take years to do it. In this country, it can be done in a very relatively short period of time. So,
with the Knights of Columbus, the degrees come, I think, with time. You've been in the organization a long time. You've been raising money for this particular school or this particular charity. You've done a good job, so up you go.
Mm-hmm. And I think charity is a large focus on both of our organizations. I know the founding story of Reverend McGivney, when he founded the KFC, they dedicated themselves to principles of charity and unity, fraternity, patriotism, and particularly charity that revolved around widows and orphans that had been left outside of society's scope and reach. And at that point, since Catholics did have, especially with the Irish influx that came into the country around those periods of time, since there was a particular cultural bias, a lot of those individuals weren't able to go into the labor unions and find the sustenance that they needed after the fact if the primary breadwinner was lost. And it seemed to be an answer to a palpable need at that point. So,
well, it's interesting you say that, because right now we have an enormous influx of illegal aliens in the country, and legal. You know, we really don't even need to make illegals legal, because, for example, last year, 1.5 million foreigners were welcomed into the United States officially. They are now legal, and that goes on every year. But to reference your point, one of the early commentators, I think in the 1900s, on the Knights of Columbus, said that the Knights of Columbus served one particular area very, very well, and that is to kind of meld together the Italians and the Irish and the Germans. It became a focal point where they could have a commonality, and that's why the Knights stressed patriotism, to bring these people from their foreign mentality to the American mentality.
Mm-hmm.
And probably the Masons did the same thing, just by virtue of coming together.
In the same thing, and I think that's been a hallmark of both of those organizations, is that they have really gotten into the core American community experience and helped build that in a much more assimilated outward direction. And I mean, we've always had neighborhoods within this country, but it seems like from the days when I was even a boy, those neighborhoods are becoming much less distinct than what I remember. So,
yeah, well, when I grew up, we had the Italian neighborhood and the Irish neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody else wasn't even welcome in either of those neighborhoods.
Yeah, yeah.
But the Irish and the Italian, somehow or other, they could fight together, but they all intermarried. My family, which is Italian on both my father's side and my mother's side, we used to dominate, because my mother had 13 brothers and sisters. My father had 7 brothers and sisters, which means I had a lot of aunts.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they had to get married. And it looked like all of them married into Irish families. So our family now was dominated by the Irish. We've lost the Italian domination totally.
You bet.
Yeah, I think organizations, obviously, they help bring disparate elements together.
Yeah, and I think people look for common elements of reference, because within the first 25 years of the Knights of Columbus existence, they grew to about 230,000 members nationwide. So obviously there
it answered
was
a need.
It did. And it addressed an appeal of what people were looking for. Freemasonry came to this country with the Revolutionary War through Great Britain in some of the military lodges. And as far as the component lodge system, at least is what my research and understanding has been, that has been a very British-based issue. As far as some of the higher grades, that was more a French vehicle that came to us by way of the Caribbean and up through the Tidewater South, and that brings with it a certain different flair. They all met in Charleston about the 1800s, and then at that point started editorializing themselves into a codified organization up to the period of time when John Quincy Adams was president. There was such a prevalence of Masonry that there was then a backlash for fear that perhaps there was one group or one organization that might be dominating the political landscape, and then there was an anti-Masonic movement. And perhaps to a certain degree, which may offend some of my Masonic brethren, maybe rightly so, because the issue is those communities had built so strongly and those relationships had developed so broadly that perhaps that was less desirable, or may have been less desirable from a much more heterodox type of pluralistic culture that we've got now.
That's very interesting. You know, once again, I'd like to go back to what I said when we first started, and that is that people come to everything with a pre-mindset. Unfortunately, we try to break that down. You know, Jesus said, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you. And I don't know how many Christians really believe that or try to practice that, because if they did, they'd have an open mind even to people who are declared enemies. I mean, sometimes when I hear people screaming, for example, we will never talk to the Iranians, I think that's a ridiculous stance. And it's, once again, it's based on pre-thinking and pre-judgmental attitudes. For example, I say to some of my friends, look, I'm of Italian origin, you're of French origin, he's of German origin, he's of Irish origin, and all of these people talk to the Iranians. Why can't we talk to the Iranians? So it's a particular mindset we have in this country, which is very strange, because in Europe, you have pretty much, France is pretty much Frenchman, and England is pretty much English. And you would think they would have more difficulty doing that than a nation that's pluralistic. I mean, we have Iranians in this country, we have Arabs in this country, we have Italians in this country. You think it would be easier for us to have learned, because we learned to dialogue with each other on a day-to-day basis. So talking to the Iranians, just sitting down with them, it doesn't cost you anything.
Sure. And I think both organizations speak to issues of fraternity, which I look at as issues of brotherhood, which ultimately may be the best label. Just a segue. I'll tell you a story from back in my college days when I went to undergraduate school and had a wonderful experience there. But one of the best lessons I learned wasn't inside the classroom. I was studying in an open quadrangle, a student thoroughfare, and members of our psychology department came out with a box of about a dozen hard-boiled eggs. And they put the egg out in the middle of the student thoroughfare. And for about the next hour, people saw the egg, acknowledged the egg, but basically did their best to go around and avoid it and not do it any harm. And then after about that hour, they went out and took a small little 3x5 index card and set it up in front of the egg. And all they had on the 3x5 card was the word egg. And people went out of their way to step on this egg, kick it, This went on to the point where they ran out of eggs because, well, they stopped the experiment because someone took a flying leap from across the quadrangle and jump on this thing. The moral of the story for me was labels are dangerous things.
Dangerous things.
Yeah, and you best be careful of how you either label yourself or others because you will pay for that labeling. And so I think brotherhood or a brother, which is how a Mason will style himself to another individual, regardless of ethnicity or religious origin or political affiliation or sect or culture, is about as good and as liberal, so to speak, Catholic, if you will, as we get. For fear of dividing ourselves along lines that basically don't open us up to dialogue and cooperation.
Usually within our own group, we can do that. Like if a Catholic meets another Catholic and they happen to be Italian or they happen to belong to another, some kind of organization, they're still embraced. But they limit that sometimes. Mm-hmm. Many Catholics limit that just to the Catholic group.
Mm-hmm.
And once they get outside of it, all their defenses come up and...
Okay, from there. Yeah. What are some of the charities that Knights of Columbus focus on?
Well, they're very high on helping local schools. And, of course, they always have a Catholic school that they can help to buy some equipment for the school or aid the school in one way or another. That's pretty high with them.
Yeah. And then there was insurance. Program was...
That's for the people within... They have a very good insurance policy for Knights.
And that was an interesting concept, but certainly within the grassroots insurance effort, that was a seminal event.
It was a very big event.
Distributing low-cost contribution across a broad, not necessarily subscription-based, but that's basically what it amounted to, that then could be used for individuals who didn't have that opportunity.
It became a model, actually, even like for industry to get together. Yeah. And it was a breakthrough in the insurance. Yeah.
And Freemasonry has focused over the years on any number of charities. We have certainly scholarship programs within the organization as well as funding for research for schizophrenia. Scottish Rite is particularly involved with children's learning centers for dyslexia, which has been just fantastically successful. And of course, people are very familiar with the Shriners organization, which is an outgrowth of Masonry with their orthopedic and their children's burns hospital, which provide that care free of charge. And Knights of Columbus have almost a equivalent shrine group that they call the Order of Alhambra. So again, another outgrowth of modeling that took place at that junction too. So.
Well, what you and I are both saying, John, is that both organizations do an enormous amount of good work. They don't have any ill will toward anybody. So this might be the moment to talk about what is the Catholic Church's position. By the way, that's somewhat misunderstood, and so I'd like to explain that. And what was the origin of it? Generally speaking, Catholics believe that if a Catholic joins the Masons, they will be excommunicated from the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. And so I'd like to go into that a bit because, first of all, that's not true. As you know, the Catholic Church, like all organizations, is run by a set of laws. Mm-hmm. And the Catholic set of laws is the code, mm-hmm. the canons of the Church.
And specifically, that was the code of canon law from back in about 1917.
Yes, I'm talking about the 1917 code. Mm-hmm. The 1917 code forbade Catholics to join any organization that had secret ceremonies. So that was interpreted as meaning any and all societies that had secret ceremonies. So the Masons came under that prescription. Not as Masons, but as being a secret society.
Being perceived as that, yeah. And that's been a problem that Masonry has I shouldn't say a problem, it's a misconception that Masonry has labored under for any number of years and still does. And our contention has always been you can go to any bookstore, any library, you can pick up probably the whole ritual. If you have a desire to go through the whole ritual,
you could find out.
And the issue is we're not a secret society because our regalia, our rings, our pins clearly define who we are. We don't secret the fact of who we are. But there are certain things that we do in private, like a family does, like a church does, like an organization does, that isn't necessarily open to the public until the public comes in within that organization. So,
well, you know, Benjamin Franklin said that the biggest secret about Masonry is that there are really no secrets, which I think that was very good. But this business of the 1917 code, that held until 1983. And in 1983, the canon law was changed. And instead of saying excommunicated, which the 1917 code said, it said cannot receive the Holy Communion. Now, that's very, very different from being excommunicated from the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. It's more like a slap on the wrist. And that's what the present code says. So if there are any Catholics out there listening, you will not be excommunicated if you join the Mason. You will get a slap on the wrist, and the church would probably prefer still that you don't. Although the Masons are not specifically mentioned, once again, in the 1983 code. They're simply referring again to secret societies.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a rule in the Catholic Church, but it's so weak that not too much attention is paid to it.
And I don't think that, at least within the generations that I grew up with in the fraternity, certainly any number of my officers and my co-members are of the Catholic faith. But again, it's our culture within the lodge not to accentuate those issues for fear that those are more divisive.
Yes.
If we really started sitting down and talking about dogma at that point, as well as politics and other issues. And so from that standpoint, Masonry has always looked toward the level playing field in terms of one of their core cultures, which is equality, and trying to see all people as equals at that point.
Well, let me jump in here, John.
Okay.
Another very important thing, I'm addressing Catholics here because I want them to understand what the church really says, how serious they take it, and so on. The 1917 ban on Catholics joining Masons also had, besides the whole question of the general thing about secret societies, the church came from this perspective that in Europe there were at least perceptions that elements of the Masons were trying to overthrow a government or undermine governments. And that's what the church was preoccupied with. Well, that situation totally, completely no longer exists. And so I think it's important for Catholics not to get excited about Masonry.
And, you know, it's an interesting point because I think you can understand the historical perspective of how that impression might have been developed, because you look at seminal revolutionary events through the world, and before those things had to take place, there had to be an enlightenment, there had to be some degree of egalitarianism, there had to be an opportunity of free thought and free thinkers to come together. And part of Freemasonry's vague founding story, and they still grapple with ultimate origins, they're not quite sure how all this came out of the woodwork until the formation of the Grand Lodge, the Mother Lodge in 1717 in Great Britain. But it seems like whenever issues of society became repressive, Masonry was the door that people walked through to have the opportunity to, in some cases, clandestinely come together or secretively come together to express opinions that they couldn't in public. And as those revolutions take place, you see a number of people, the Bolivars, the Garibaldis, all of a sudden also have these fraternal affiliations. And it's easy to make the juxtaposition between one and the other and say, oh, if A, then therefore B, and all B then becomes C. And I can see how that could become a bias that could be easily formed, but may not necessarily be rooted in fact.
I think this is an area where we can complement the origin of Masonry, because I think Masonry was more an outgrowth of the Enlightenment period in Europe. People were tired of either the church dominating society or the state-dominating mm-hmm. society. Mm-hmm. The European Masons inspired the American revolutionaries. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I think if we really took an honest look at early Masonry, we say, hey, these people were trying to overthrow a government, all right, but oppressive governments. Mm-hmm. We overthrew an oppressive government in the United States, and that revolution has sparked one of the great nations in the history of mankind.
Truly, truly.
So let me give a little compliment to the Masons.
And by the same token, the compliment to the Knights of Columbus, I think, for me and my research, came through the First World War. Because if Masons drop the ball on their core values and their organizational raison d'etre, their reason for being, basically, is that they weren't able to go over and support the effort during the First World War. And I say that not from a military standpoint, but from a infrastructure support the troops standpoint. And they tried, but because of the way we were organized, because there is no central authority for Masonry across the face of the United States. It is state by state, or in the case of higher degree Masonry, it is jurisdiction by jurisdiction. The northern jurisdiction has 15 or 16 states. The southern jurisdiction comprises the rest of the U.S. and territories. And the War Department came to us and said, you know, we're not interested in dealing with, at that point, 40-some different localities. And to that extent, you see not a great deal of history during the First World War as far as Masonry's involvement going back to its charitable support or its social support overseas, whereas Knights of Columbus were right there. And that's to their great credit, too. I mean, they gave a lot of sustenance and succor and support to those organizations before and after that First World War conflict. So.
Well, John, I hope the people who are listening to us will join us in fellowship. I'm going to invite you to go out and have pizza with me, and you could invite me out to have something that you'd like. And you know, just get rid of all of this awful finger-pointing and ridiculous historical analogies and just see these two organizations as people who are trying to help local communities. Mm-hmm. So I would encourage all my fellow Catholics to do this. Within a month, invite a Mason out for pizza. And start talking about what you have in common rather than try to look darkly into some historical event.
Yeah, I think the future is certainly much brighter than looking back to a past which may have been dark and difficult for anybody.
And badly understood. Mm-hmm. Like this whole question of the Masons really coming alive as a result of the Enlightenment that was beginning, that spread all through Europe mm-hmm. and led to revolutions that got rid of dictatorial governments.
Well, and you know, isn't it the truth that, at least my perception has always been, that any institution, especially if it has either a monopoly or it's got a corner on the market of anything, tends to behave in such a way as to preserve its authority. And
the institution always gets preserved, no matter who gets trampled
mm-hmm,
on.
Mm-hmm. and certainly during its day, the church was the place for education, and if not education, then certainly dictum. And anything that violated that was a threat. And hopefully we've become less parochial in our attitude yes. after everything is said and done. Yeah. So.
Well, you and I are both opting for that.
The day of isolationism for both of our organizations is long past. And I think we're to that point in the world, certainly. I think the time has come as our organizations have grown, and now we're in a certain period of contraction. And I think because of that contraction, we'll start to re-green, so to speak. They will start to grow again. I think now is the time for us to recognize that what separated us no longer has a place in this world. And we need to communicate, we need to collaborate, we need to productively go into the next centuries to come and continue to build the communities that both of us are rightly proud of having helped build in the past.
I agree totally.
Well, Father Pat, what do you say we go have some pizza?
I'm tired and I'm hungry, and that would really do a lot for me.
It's a deal. Let's do it.